Okay, everyone. Let's go straight in so that we're not wasting too much time. So again, can you hear me okay? Yeah. So again, we have this period of rest, don't we? 40 years, a period of rest. And as we said before, periods of rest are dangerous. Okay, because what happens in periods of rest is that you stop fighting. Now, you might think, well, that's a good thing, isn't it, to stop fighting? What we're talking about here, though, is spiritually. Okay, when we are spiritually fighting, now that may mean externally, so is that, you know, we're doing our preaching work, we're going out there, we are preaching. It could be internal as well. I mean, sometimes, you know, there are problems, there are difficult decisions that we have to make in our meetings. But what that forces us to do is forces us to turn back to the Bible, to look at the Bible, going back to the basics. And the same when we're preaching out there and we're talking to people, it makes us turn to the Bible. The danger of having periods of rest is that we stop fighting. What we do is we go into this state of compromise. Because at the end of the day, fighting is difficult, isn't it? Nobody wants to fight. Everyone just wants to get along with everybody else and take it easy. But that's not what is demanded of us as Christians. We are there in order to stand up and fight for what we believe. And so it is here with the nation of Israel in verse 1 of chapter 6 of Judges. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And that's the fifth time now that this evil in the sight of the Lord is mentioned. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens, which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds. And what a sad state of affairs that is. The Midianites were a nomadic tribe. Okay, they had the camels and they travelled around with no set abode. But what they did is they followed the food. So probably once a year when the harvest came to Israel, they thought, I know, let's go to Israel and we'll go and raid their food. So the Midianites would move into Israel's territory. They would take over the land. They would steal all the food. Now, verse 2 seems to suggest that Israel tried to put up some sort of resistance. It says the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. So it sounds like Israel tried to fight back. And there are indications later on in Gideon that there were previous fights. Gideon mentions certainly there was a fight on Mount Tabor in which his brothers were killed. So during this 7 year period, the Israelites were trying to fight back. But gradually, over a process of time, what happened is that Israel shrunk back. They shrunk back, as it says, into their dens and into their caves and into their strongholds. And sometimes that is what can happen to us as a community or as an ecclesia. The pressures that we face now from the world and the philosophy of the day, it has this constant encroachment, doesn't it, into our lives, whether it's issues around humanism or equal rights or LGBT or different theistic evolution, all these different things that are coming into our community. And what happens is it gradually just picks away after the generations go by, until in the end we just give up. We give up and we stop fighting and we shrink back, don't we? And when we think about maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago, the Christadelphians were out there, weren't they? We were on the streets, we were preaching, we were vocal. And nowadays we've sort of shrunk back into our little dens and our caves, because gradually the world has that sort of impact upon us. And that's exactly what was happening in the days of Israel during the time of Gideon. Verse 3, and so it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites and the children of the east, even they came up against them, they encamped against them and destroyed all the increase of the earth till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor ass. So they completely took away everything that the Israelites had to eat. So we can see that when we come to Gideon, That's why he's hiding away in a wine press, threshing the wheat, because he's hiding away from the Midianites. He's hiding his stores of food. 7 years. Why did it take 7 years for the nation of Israel to cry out to God? Well, I think we've probably already answered that, haven't we? Because what happens is when it first happens, you put up a bit of resistance. Okay, the Midianites go away and you think, okay, we've dealt with that, we're okay now. Then it happens again and you have to deal with it again, and then it goes away and it keeps coming back. And every time it comes back stronger and more forceful, up to a stage where the Midianites then were encroaching right down the valley of Jezreel. And it even says that they all then went down the coast, the western coast, and we'll have a look at this in a minute, all the way down the western coast, even to Gaza, which was bordering on Philistine territory. So they'd almost done this whole U-shape of infiltration into the nation of Israel. So after 7 years, everyone had just given up. And they cried unto the Lord. They could no longer deal with it themselves. Seven's quite a key number, I think, in this passage. If we go to Leviticus chapter 26, let's just turn that up. Because this is the chapter, this is a well-known chapter here on the blessings and the cursings that were to come upon Israel. And depending on how the nation of Israel acted, God said, I will either bless you or I will curse you. And we can see from the record in Gideon that they turned away from God, hadn't they? So the curses came upon them. What's it say there in verse 15 there? And if ye shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhor my judgments, so that ye will not do all my commandments, but that ye break the covenant. So this was all about the children of Israel breaking the covenant of God. And the covenant of God was a covenant, a promise that he made with them, that if they obeyed him, then he would bless them. And if they didn't, then he would curse them. So they had brought on the curses of the covenant. Verse 25, and I will bring a sword upon you and shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. And when ye are gathered together within your cities, I will send the pestilence among you, and ye shall be delivered into the hand of your enemy. So that is the punishment of breaking the covenant, is that God would deliver them into the hand of the enemy. It tells us that the children of Israel worship the Baals. After Gideon, it says that they worship Baal Beroth. Okay, I think I put the quote up there, 8:33. Now, Beroth means covenant. So what the people have tried to do after the days of Gideon is they've tried to reach this compromise situation where they want to worship the God of the covenant, i.e. God, but they also want to amalgamate it with their worship of the Baals and the Asherah. Okay, so what they've then done is created another God, which is not only the God of Israel, but is the God of the Baals and the Asherah as well. And we're very much in danger of doing that, aren't we? And that's exactly what the Roman Catholics did under Constantine, wasn't it? When they brought in Christianity as the religion of the Roman Empire, what they said is, well, we can't leave all those other religions within our empire. What we will do is we will amalgamate all those different religions, and then we will join them together with Christianity, and we will make one religion, and we'll make one God. And that's exactly what the people have done here. They've tried to amalgamate all the different gods to keep everyone happy, and therefore they started to worship the gods, plural, of the covenant. Verse 16, I also will do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague. I'm not too sure what the burning ague is, if anyone's got any ideas. That shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. And here it is, and ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. So there's a direct correlation here between the curse that God was going to send on the people, and this curse came true, didn't it, during the days of Gideon. It says almost the exact same words. They sowed their seed, but they never got to eat it because the enemy took it away. Verse 17, "And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They shall hate you, shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursue you." So this is the idea that they weren't being pursued, but Israel had chosen to flee away. They'd chosen to go and hide in their dens and in their caves because they just didn't want that confrontation anymore. And as you go through this chapter in chapter 26, the punishment is seven. It comes out verse 18, "I will punish you seven times more for your sins." Verse 24, "Then will I also walk contrary to you and will punish you seven times for your sins." And so this number seven then, 7 years of punishment from the Midianites, it tells us from Gideon. It's also the old enemies, isn't it? Midianites and the Amalekites. And these aren't new enemies to Israel. We know all about the Amalekites, don't we? The Amalekites come up in Exodus chapter 17. And if you remember, when the children of Israel were wandering through the wilderness, the Amalekites were there at the back, taking away the weak and those that were at the back. And the Amalekites preyed on the children of Israel. And therefore, God says, the Amalekites will be your enemy from generation to generation. And so it is through the Bible. The Amalekites were always there in the background. And the Midianites, we know from Numbers chapter 25, if you remember, when they were just about to cross over the Jordan, they were all ready to go into the promised land. And if you remember, the curse of Balaam, Balaam sends in the Midianites and he sends in the women in order to go and seduce the children of Israel. And if you remember, Phinehas gets his spear, if you remember, and goes into the tent and drives it through the people that are committing adultery before God. So the Midianites are seductive, okay? They're wild, they beguile you. So we've got the Amalekites and the Midianites, and they are the enemies of Israel spiritually as well as physically. And so it is with us. The battles that we're fighting now, the arguments that we're having nowadays with regards to our scriptures and everything, and our preaching, are the same battles that our fathers had. Same battles that our grandparents had. Okay, it never goes away. But it's a constant enemy in the background there that we have to keep addressing and addressing and keep on top of it. This is Psalm 83. You don't need to turn to it. I've sort of tried to lift out all the appropriate bits here. But Psalm 83 is about, particularly about this period of Gideon's judgeship over Israel. Verse 5 there, it talks about the enemies conspiring with one accord. So you've got this confederacy of nations coming against Israel. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites and Moab, or the Ishmaelites and the Moabites, were connected with the Midianites. Then you've got Gebal, Ammon and Amalek. Again, that's the nation mentioned in Gideon's time. Do to them as you did to Midian. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb. Well, Oreb, Zeb, Zebar and Zalmunna were leaders of the Midianite confederacy. So that's the period it's talking about. But what was their intent? What was the intent of the Midianites? Well, this is what they're saying. Let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God. So what they really wanted was to take over the land from the Israelites. So every year they made incursions, they came further and further in, but what they really wanted was the land. They wanted to take Israel's inheritance. And there's a danger there, isn't there, in our lives too, that if we let the world infiltrate into our lives too much, it will take away our inheritance. And that's really important, that we have to keep fighting back. We have to keep fighting back because we don't want to lose our inheritance in the kingdom because our enemies eventually take us over. And verse 13 there, I thought it was quite interesting.
Oh my God, when them make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind. So make the enemies flee away. And that's what they do, isn't it? When Gideon smashes the vases, brings the torches out, the enemies go into disarray. And they run around like a whirling dust. As fire consumes the forest, as the flames set the mountains ablaze. And we've got a nice image there, haven't we, of all the firebrands being shone on the mountains as they surround the Midianites. And then in the middle of that is this whirling dust as the enemies flee away. So let's go back to Judges chapter 6 then, and then let's pick up the story of Gideon. He's an interesting character, I think, Gideon, because we're not too sure where his starting point is. Now, let me just go on to explain that, because where we find Gideon is in verse 11. Now, before that, God answers their cry by sending them a prophet. And the prophet comes and basically tells them that they're in this situation because they've neglected the covenant. The angel talks about how God delivered them out of Egypt, how he delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all those that had pressed them before. But because they didn't turn back to him, that's now why they're back in this same situation. And I think that would have really affected Gideon. I think, you see, that Gideon was a man of honour. Gideon was one of those men that had been previously fighting against the Midianites. Because the angel, when the angel comes in verse 12, he refers to Gideon as a mighty man of valour. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that he's going to become a mighty man of valour? Or does that mean that the angel knows that actually Gideon is a man of valour and therefore he's already proved himself on the battlefield? And I think that Gideon was one of those people, along with his brothers, who had previously been fighting against the Midianites. But it all got too much, and in the end, Gideon himself had to give up. But he didn't like it. It really upset him. And then when this prophet came along and said, well, you're in this situation because you've not done what I said, Gideon would have been thinking about that, and that would have really concerned him. And we know that because it comes out. Verse 11, and there came an angel of the Lord and sat under the oak, which was at Ophrah, and pertained unto Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. And you can see Gideon, can't you, thinking about this and taking it out on the wheat. Maybe he is bashing this wheat around thinking, you know, I'm really frustrated at the fact that nobody is doing anything about this. And sometimes that's how we can get frustrated, isn't it? Is that we really want something to happen and we're waiting for everybody else to do something about it. What we don't do is we don't look at ourselves and we don't say to ourselves, well, why aren't I doing anything about it? I could do something about it. Let's see how it unfolds. Verse 12. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, the Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valour. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, did not the Lord bring us out from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. Now look how many times there it says us. And that's what godly people do. They associate themselves with the sins of the people. Okay, it's not look at them. It's look at us. I'm just as bad as everybody else. And therefore Gideon, is what he's saying is, why has God done this to us? Where are all the miracles that he showed? Why isn't he performing miracles? Why isn't he delivering us out of the hands of the Midianites now? And how often do we do that in our own lives? What we try and do is we try and blame everybody else apart from ourselves. And Gideon here is saying, why has God done this to us? Now, there's a phrase that I use quite a bit, and I've actually put it onto an overhead because I like it that much. The quote at the top is not this quote underneath, okay, but it relates to these verses. And this quote is this: don't let the situation you are in define what you think about God, but let what you know about God define the situation that you are in. Now, that's quite a long statement, isn't it? But what does that actually mean? What it means is this: is that we can look at our situation and we can blame God for it. And we can say, God, why have you put me in this situation? Where are you when I need you the most? Why aren't you helping me? And that's what we do. And that is defining God by the situation that we're in. What we should be doing is turning that around, and we should be saying, well, what do, first and foremost, what do I know about God? I know God is faithful. I know God is merciful. I know God has worked in my life in the past. I know God will be true to me, whatever happens to me. So when we know those things and when we look to God at those things, then we can look at the situation we're in and we can say, ah, I'm in this situation because God wants me to be in this situation. And therefore, I now need to do something myself in order to put me right with God again. And that's what it means. Don't judge your situation. Don't judge God by your situation, but let what you know about God define the situation that you're in. And if we have that attitude of mind and we realise that God is a constant, God doesn't move. God is constant in our lives. So the things that happen around God, we can't blame God for them. Okay, because God is constant. What we have to do is, well, why am I in this situation? And what does God want me to do? So he goes on this little rant then for verse 13. Why this? Why that? Verse 14. And the Lord, the angel, looked upon him and say, go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? And the phrase I like in here is that it says, and the Lord looked upon him. And that word means he turned and looked on Gideon. And have you ever had it where you're moaning about something? Okay, you're probably getting cross about something. You're whinging about something. And then maybe a parent or maybe somebody else turns and gives you that look. And that look says, stop your moaning. Okay, stop your moaning. You know what you've got to do, therefore get on and do it. And that's what the angel says to Gideon. Gideon, you're the mighty warrior here. You're the responsible person here. You are a prince. You are a leader in your community. So why are you blaming everybody else when you are the one that can start this? And then verse 14, here we go. Here's the excuses. Verse 15, sorry. And he said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And the Lord said unto him, surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. Excuses, isn't it? Have you ever been asked to do something? And what you say is, I can't do that. I've not been trained to do that. If I do it, I'm going to make a real mess of it. There's somebody over there who's much better than I am. If they do it, they'll do a perfect job of it. And do you know what? You're right. Because there is always going to be somebody else that can do a better job than you can. There's always going to be somebody else who's going to do the perfect job. But that's exactly the reason why God has asked you. Okay? Because what we're going to see in Gideon's life is that this is not about the battle. Okay, deliverance comes to the Israelites through this. But what this is about is that this is about Gideon's relationship with God. Okay? And therefore, what God is doing here is he's putting it back onto Gideon and saying, this is your responsibility, Gideon. Don't try and get out of it. But the reason I'm asking you to do it is because I want you to be developed as a result of it. And when you look through the life of Gideon, just think about this for a moment. Gideon has to do all these things. He has to go and destroy the altar in his father's backyard. We'll have a look at that in a minute. He then has to arrange for the armies to be gathered. He has to put a plan in place in how he's going to defeat the Midianites. At the end, he has to end up killing the leaders. Okay, so God puts this great responsibility on Gideon to do all these things. But at the end of the day, who is it that does the fighting? God. Gideon doesn't have to do any of the fighting against the Midianites. So he puts Gideon through all these things that Gideon has to do. And yet the end task is completed by God. Because it's not about the task. What God asks us to do is not about the outcome. Because God can do anything. God can do it himself. God can get somebody else to do it. It's not about the outcome. What it's about is about the development that takes place as part of that. And therefore, Gideon is taken through this journey of development. And it's Gideon only in the Judges that has this constant dialogue with God. None of the other judges do. Okay, we get instances where Samson sort of prays to God. We get the instance where it tells the Spirit of the Lord came upon the judge. But it's only with Gideon that we get this dialogue between Gideon and God. And as soon as the Midianites are destroyed, that dialogue stops. Now, that doesn't mean to say that God has deserted Gideon. What it means now is that God has brought Gideon to a place where he can now go ahead and do it on his own. And Gideon then goes on and finishes the task himself. I think we're jumping ahead. I'm going off piste again. Okay, so excuses, excuses. What do you think about faith? If somebody asks you to go out and do something in faith, faith implies, doesn't it, that we go out boldly and we go out in strength and we take that big step and we say, right, I'm going to do this. That's not what faith is about. Faith is about being weak and not wanting to do something and really struggling to do something, but doing it anyway. And that's the case here with Gideon. Is that the title of this talk is Gideon the Reluctant. He was reluctant. He'd been stung in the past. He'd sort of given up all hope. He felt that things would never be resolved. And therefore, God is coaching Gideon through all of this. And we get the incident, don't we, with this fleece. Now, I'm not too sure what you think about Gideon and this fleece. We know the story, don't we, how that Gideon wants reassurance from God. And he says, okay, God, I want you to know, I want you to tell me that you're with me. I want some reassurance. And Gideon says, okay, put out the fleece. And in the morning, if the fleece is wet and the ground's dry, and then he says, oh no, now change it around. And the next morning, if the ground is wet and the fleece is dry, then that will show that you're with me. And Gideon goes through all of this in order to prove that God is with him. Now, I don't really know whether there's another interpretation. These are a few ideas. So the dew, what can the dew represent? Well, dew in the Bible is about a blessing from God. So maybe this dew coming on the fleece and on the ground shows that God was blessing Gideon. Dew is also referred to as doctrine, instruction in the word. It came before the manna. If you remember, the dew was on the ground and the manna appeared. There's also reference there about resurrection, how that the dew is refreshing and how it brings life and how it waters the earth and gives life. The dew on Mount Hermon is talking about unity. So it's something that brings everything together. The fleece and the earth, again, just some suggestions here. Maybe the symbol of the fleece and the earth, it's God's blessing on Gideon, the fleece, and on the land, possibly. Maybe it shows that there is going to be victory in the land of Israel and then victory outside of the land of Israel. So if you remember, the final battle was actually won outside of Israel. Maybe it means that God's going to bring a blessing on the Israel and on the Gentiles, the fleece and the land. Maybe it talks about resurrection. So as Jesus is like the dew that comes on those that sleep in the dust and brings about resurrection. But if anyone's got any other views on that, it would be interesting to hear them. But verse 17, Judges 6, and the angel said unto him, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. So Gideon then finds grace from God. And verse 23, and the Lord said unto him, peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die. So grace is shown by God, and as a result of that, peace comes to Gideon. Okay, and this idea of peace is feeling at one, being at one with God, and totally submitting yourself to the will of God. And if we can get into a situation where we're at peace with God, it means that our lives, our thoughts are completely submitted to the will of God. Okay, let's have a look then. These are the Midianites. This is the what happened. So the Midianites were coming from over here. And what they were doing every year, they were crossing the Jordan Valley, and they were going up this valley here, which is the Valley of Jezreel, which is a nice flat area of land. And I'll show you a photograph of that in a minute. And then it says they often then came down this coastal plain, again, which is quite flat, and they would come down as far as Gaza. So you can see how much of an area of land the Midianites encroached into Israel. But what happens? Well, Gideon calls the tribes of Israel together. Verse 33 of chapter 6, and all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. So we're talking about here, there's Mount Tabor where there was a battle earlier, but the Midianites were gathered about here. Okay. Verse 34, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, it clothed him. Okay, what a lovely idea is that the Spirit of the Lord, the power of God, clothed Gideon. Okay, and he blew a trumpet, and Ebiezer was gathered after him, and he sent messengers throughout Manasseh, who was also gathered after him, and he sent messengers unto Asher, unto Zebulun, and unto Naphtali. So, when Gideon made the call, people came. And there's a big lesson there that we can learn. You see, everyone sits around thinking somebody else is going to do the job. And we're all thinking the same thing, thinking, I wish somebody would just go and do something about this. And everyone's thinking the same. And then one person stands up and says, I'm going to do something about this. And then all of a sudden, everyone else says, okay, yeah, let's do something about it. And before you know it, everybody is on board with it. And that's a really important thing, that if you are the person in your friendship group, the person that says, let's go and do this good thing, you will find out that all your other friends are thinking exactly the same thing, but they were too scared to say it. Okay, so get something going, get your friends involved, and when you put out the call for help, I can guarantee people will come and help you. And that's exactly what Gideon does. He puts out the cry for help and people come. Now, there's a tribe missing there. Anyone know which tribe is missing? I mean, there's lots of tribes missing. But in this particular area here, there is a tribe missing. And the tribe is Issachar. Why is Issachar missing from there? Issachar was one of the tribes that responded to Deborah's call when there was a fight. So it's not that they were scared. Issachar was a tribe that would go out and fight. Okay, why are Issachar missing? Well, when we look at the map, we see here the Jezreel Valley. And where were the Midianites camped? Right slap bang in the territory of Issachar. You see, Brother Issachar could not make it on that day because poor old Brother Issachar had 135,000 Midianites camped on his drive. Okay, they brought the camels along, they brought everything along, and therefore he had his hands full of Midianites. And sometimes we can be very critical within our meetings. If we haven't seen a brother or a sister for a long time, you know, they're always there. Where's Brother Issachar and his wife, Sister Issachar? Where are they? They haven't been for a few weeks. Oh, they must be going off the path. They must be spiritually weak. And we can sometimes get into that way of thinking. Why does Sister Issachar never turn up on time? Why she's always the last one in the room and she comes in at 11:15 when everyone else has started at 11? We don't know what the circumstances are in people's lives. And sometimes the very fact that people have turned up is a massive thing for them. And on this occasion, Issachar couldn't turn up because he had all these Midianites camped on his doorstep. So what happens is the other tribes rally around in order to help. And that's what we should do. If somebody's struggling in our meeting, then we should rally around and help. We should provide them maybe with food if they haven't got any food. We should provide them with transport if they haven't got any transport. The main thing is that we don't do anything. And so it is that all the tribes around Issachar rally together. Manasseh, Naphtali, Asher, Zebulun, Manasseh, they all come together in order to help Brother Issachar out of his plight and to get the camels off his drive. Okay, so that's why Issachar doesn't turn up. Let's have a look at the Jezreel Valley. That's a picture of the Jezreel Valley. If you've ever been to Israel, you may have seen that. If you go into Israel, then try and pay a visit. It's a lovely place. And you can see, look, can't you, all the farms and the fields. And you can see why that is an ideal place to grow your crops. And that's where Israel grew their crops. And that's where the Midianites came in. And this is the place where it happened. So we've got Mount Tabor in the back there, which is where another battle happened, according to the scriptures. Then you've got this hill of Morah. And then here you've got, you can't see it, but there's a hill of Gilboa here. And then you've got the plain in between. And the Midianites would have been camped somewhere around here, probably quite a large area if there's 135,000 of them. And camped at this side here was Gideon and his army. So let's have a read, see what happens. Chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Harod. The well of Harod is it's just in front of Gilboa, somewhere down here. Word Harod means they're trembling or fearful, because that's where, as we go on to read, when he said, if there's anyone fearful or trembling in your army, tell them to go. So 32,000 people turned up for the battle from Israel. And it's all right turning up, isn't it, when you're feeling brave. Okay, when everyone says, come on, let's go and fight the Midianites. Oh yeah, let's all go along. 32,000 of them turn up. When you actually eye the enemy, and I can imagine looking down from here and they see that 135,000 Midianites there, all of a sudden things start to change and people start getting fearful. And so God says, if any of them are fearful, tell them to go away. Verse 3, now therefore go to proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And there returned of the people 22,000, and there remained 10,000. And this was actually in the law written by Moses in Deuteronomy. Moses said, if you've got an army and there's lots of people in there that are scared, tell them to leave. Because in an army situation, you don't want people that are running around not knowing what they're doing. And when you're trying to attack, they're all running in the other way. So you can see the logic behind it. But there's also something else here as well. There is a process of judgment happening here, isn't there? The Bible says, many are called, but few are chosen. And this 22,000 people chose themselves to take themselves out of the battle. And so it is with us. We've got a choice, haven't we? I said earlier that choice is the most important thing that you've got in your life. What choices are you going to make? And these people had a choice. They either fight for God or they leave. And therefore, in effect, these 22,000 had judged themselves. We're not up for the fight. I don't want to hear it. I don't want any more about this. And so it happens, sadly, in our community, isn't it? That some people just give up the fight and they think, you know, I don't want any more. And they leave our community, which is really, really sad. But they make that choice themselves. They choose not to continue with the fight. So we left them with 10,000 people. What happens to these 10,000 people? Verse 4, and the Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with me. Now we know this story. They all go down to the well. Some of them just stick their heads in the water, don't they? They get down on the knees and they stick their heads in the water and they drink like that. Now some people say, well, these are the people that are bowing down to the gods that were at the well. Okay, therefore they weren't fit to fight. Possibly, I don't know, maybe they should have, might have been a shrine there and they were bowing down, I don't know. The other people, though, were vigilant, weren't they? They were sort of like kneeling down, cupped hands like this, and drinking. Okay, so again, some people think, well, because these were the ones that were vigilant and looking upwards, well, they were the ones that God wanted in his army. I have a theory of my own, okay? And I don't know whether this is correct, so I'm happy for people to disagree with it. My theory is this, okay, is that the 300 were the ones that didn't want to go into the battle. But in faith, they stayed there. And they were the ones that God wanted to go into the battle. We've talked about development, haven't we? And we've talked about sometimes having to do things that you don't want to. And sometimes you have to step out in faith. And I think God said, these are the 300 that need to do this, because these are the ones that are going to benefit the most from it. The 9,700, there was nothing wrong with them. They weren't running away. It wasn't that they were scared, because God said, well, we don't want these 9,700. So the 9,700, what happened to those? Well, I know you like your rugby here in Sale. They were the finishing team, weren't they? Yeah. So when the battle had taken place and the Midianites all spread, what happened? Gideon said, we need somebody else to help now. And all of a sudden, all these 9,700 people that had been laid off from the first battle, they now came in and finished the job. So there was nothing unfaithful about any of these people. But I think God chose the 300 that needed to be there in order to develop them and to strengthen them. Okay, and so it was. With 300 people, God and Gideon go to battle with the Midianites. Now, we've said Gideon, haven't we, that he was the reluctant one. He was the one that needed the confidence. And he was a bit scared, okay? And I don't think there's any worry about being scared about things, okay? If we're scared about something or we're worried about it, that's fine. That's exactly what God's for. That's why Jesus is in our life, because we are scared and we are worried. It's not something that's embarrassing. So Gideon's a bit like, you what? You want me to go down into the camp of the Midianites? You want me to walk down into the enemy's territory? And God said, it's okay. Take a friend with you. Take a friend with you and go and have a listen to what they're saying. And so it is that Gideon goes down with his friend. Let's just have a look where we are. Verse 10 of chapter 7. But if thou fear to go down, go thou with Purah, thy servant, down to the host. And they go down into the heart of the enemy territory. And what do they hear? Well, verse 13, and when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, and said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto the tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it that the tent lay alongside. So, why were the Midianites scared of Israel? Well, possibly they'd seen the army on the other side of the valley. And maybe their scouts had seen this army of 32,000 people turn up. And then they saw 22,000 leave. And maybe they thought, that's a bit strange. Where are they going? Are they going to come up behind us? And then they're looking again, and then another 10,000 people leave. Oh, well, where are they going? Are they maybe going around the other side? What's happening here? And then right in the middle of the night, God starts giving them dreams. Now, it only tells us about one man having a dream. Maybe God gave dreams to lots of them. And all of a sudden, the superstitious nature of the Midianites, because that's what they were a superstitious nation, things started to play on their minds. And they'd heard the fact that Gideon was over the other side. They'd heard the fact how that God worked with the nation of Israel in the past and how he delivered them from Sihon and Og and all those nations round about. And all of a sudden then the Midianites start to worry. There's a suggestion maybe God gave them a vision or a presence in the camp that made them worry. I don't know whether that's the case or not, but it's a suggestion that somebody has put forward. And so then when they saw the lights all around them, the superstition kicks in. And all of a sudden, the people start to panic and they start to fight amongst themselves. And through that, God brings the victory. What do we think of this barley bread, the vision of the barley bread? Well, barley bread here is used as a wave loaf at the Passover. It's a poor man's food. Barley was considered to be the poor man's option, not like wheat. And we know in Isaiah 53 that it's those that are despised. So the Lord Jesus was despised. And so it was that God was going to bring deliverance through the weak. The battle was being won by the lowly and despised. Jesus became the bread of life. And when it says that the barley bread tumbled down, what it means there is it turned every which way, which takes us back, doesn't it, to Genesis 3 when it talks about the cherubim in the garden with the sword, and it says the sword turned every which way to protect. About the lamps and the pitchers. Well, in Corinthians, it tells us there that we have the glory of God in earthen vessels, and the earthen vessels there, of course, referring to ourselves, is that we are something which is weak and frail, and yet inside us we contain the light of the glory of God. And in order to bring that light out, we have to break ourselves, don't we? We have to break our own self-esteem. We have to put ourselves to the back, and we have to break that, put it to death, so that the light can shine out. And so when Joshua cracked all those earthen vessels, the light shone out and the glory of God, and the Midianites fled. It's not unique. Lots of examples in scripture where God has done the fighting on behalf of the people. We know how the Egyptians were destroyed in the Red Sea. Jericho was destroyed by God, not by the people. We've got lots of examples there. Saul against the Philistines, Hezekiah, how the Assyrians were defeated. Jehoshaphat, similar way with Gideon, how they started fighting it amongst themselves. And the Gogian host and the kingdoms of the heathen. So, not a unique thing where God does the fighting. But let's have a look then at the final bit, the pursuit. So this is where the battle happens. All the nations come there, the fight happens there. And then what happens then is it all splits up and the Midianites start to run away. Some of them come down here and then they're pursued by Ephraim, who finished them off. And the leaders come down here and they go over here and they go to a place called Karkor. That's a distance of about 100 miles. So you can see now how that Gideon has grown. He's grown in his confidence. And now he's able now to take on the fight on his own without God's help, although God was still with him. And he comes down here to Karkor, and eventually he strikes down the heads of Zeba and Zalmunna. Verse 21 of chapter 8 there. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise thou and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is the strength." And Gideon arose and slew Zeba and Zalmunna and took away their ornaments that were on their camels. So the last act of Gideon was that he had to destroy the enemy. Okay, he had to defeat the enemy. And that was the last act of the Lord Jesus, wasn't it? When he hung on the cross, he had to defeat the head of sin. And it's interesting there when Zeba and Zalmunna are slain. I think it's in the next verse 28 of that chapter. It says that they lifted their heads no more. Almost as if Gideon had dealt the final blow to the heads of the Midianites. He destroyed the heads of the Midianite like Jesus destroyed the head of the serpent. But what does then Gideon do? He takes away the ornaments of their camels' necks. That's a strange thing to do. Why does he do that? For his own personal wealth? Give me all the gold. I deserve it. Well, those ornaments around the camels' necks were trinkets. They were crescents. They were little handheld gods. Okay? And Gideon is saying, give them to me, because I don't want you to take these away and then start having a little personal god in your pocket. Okay? And start worshipping that god. So Gideon takes them all away. He takes the idolatry away so that nobody else has it. But what does he then go and do with it? Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because one of the last acts of Gideon is in verse 27. And Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. Did Gideon do the wrong thing, or did he do the right thing? Well, I think what Gideon was trying to do was the right thing. He wanted to take all these gods from the Midianites and from the people. And he thought, well, what can I do with all these? I think what he tried to do is, let's have something that we can remember this by. Let's do something where we can remember what God has done for us. And he's very careful, isn't he? He doesn't make an image of God. He doesn't make an image of a person. He doesn't make an image of an animal, which can be worshipped. He makes an image of a priestly ephod, maybe thinking that that was safe. Nobody's going to worship a priestly ephod, are they? And it's a reminder to us of God and what he did. And where does he place it? He places it in Ophrah, in his father's territory. So this is now going to replace the altar that was there, the altar of Baal and the altar of Asherah. But this is now going to be a symbol of remembrance of what God has done for us. But you see, what actually happened is, in time, the people then started to worship it as a god. And we know that happened, don't we, with the brazen serpent in the image. So I suppose what the warning here is that regardless of what God does in our lives and what happens, what we've got to be careful of ourselves is, what legacy do we leave for the next generation? Because if we start setting things up which are not Bible-based, and we set these things up in our meetings, our ecclesias, to us it may mean something. Oh, that was a good way of doing that, therefore we should always do that because it's the best way of doing it. In a generation to come, they carry on with that tradition, but maybe that's not the best thing. Maybe that's the thing that may lead them astray. And therefore, we've got to be really careful about what legacy we leave.